As you know, Steve and I share hosting duties here on Morning Edition with David Greene. Not the former Georgia quarterback David Greene, or TV director David Greene, or Welsh hurdler David Greene. But do a Google search for David Greene and all those other folks will show up too. Sharing names has never been as obvious as it is today, with search engines and social media reminding us how unspecial we really are. NPR's Elise Hugh explores the difficulty of distinguishing yourself online when so many others go by the same name.
My name is Justin Dane. I'm a video journalist in Austin, Texas.
Justin Dane isn't the only Justin Dane, spelled D-E-H-N.
This is Justin.
No, wait a second. This is Justin.
What's up, dude?
How you doing, man?
After Justin Dane saw his own name on Facebook, but tied to an entirely different identity, Justin Dane friended the other Justin Dane, who's also in video production, but in Minneapolis.
And then I wrote you and I said, hey, I don't think we've ever met, but I'm assuming that you're adding me because we have the same name. And then we chatted a little bit of how we pronounced it.
Since then, they've dealt with their share of name-related mishaps.
I was getting emails from your girlfriend at the time, just like with just normal everyday notes like, hey, don't forget to take the trash out.
Or
I think I forwarded some to you like, don't forget to take the trash out.
Yeah, you did.
This kind of confusion caused by same nameness isn't new, but now it's easier than ever to find others with your name online. And with more all digital communication, mix-ups matter more, too. Judith Donath is a researcher at Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. She says online names are everything.
One of the most important things online is the reputation you build up. It's really the entirety of your identity in a world where there is no body. And when you share your name with many other people, you start sharing effectively a history and reputation with them.
In 2005, writer Mike Sager wasn't keen to share his name with so many other Mike Sagers.
I need to use my name. I'm Mike Sager.
But since he isn't the only one, Sager set out on a cross-country journey to meet the other Mike Sagers.
There was Lutheran pastor Mike Sager in Spokane. There was motorcycle racer sound technologist Mike Sager in Wenatchee, Washington. In all, I ended up getting in touch with 39 Mike Sagers and going to meet 11 Mike Sagers.
The road trip reminded him we may all want to be distinct, but we can't deny we're linked.
It gives you a better view on how we're all related in different ways as humans. And, you know, particularly by name, even if we don't know each other.
But what if you share a name with someone less than appealing, someone with a bad reputation?
We call that at Reputation.com, we call that the doppelnamer problem, obviously after the doppelganger problem, where you share the name with someone who's got a bad rep or who's someone famous, who's just not you.
That's Michael Furtick, the founder and CEO of Reputation.com. The company is among NPR's supporters, and it helps users distinguish themselves in search results because nowadays, the vast majority of people you interact with will look you up online first.
So the whole idea is to fly your flag, first of all, if you don't have one, and secondly, so to fly your flag prominently and largely enough, grandly enough, that people can find the full picture of your body of work of your life.
Donath, the Harvard researcher, thinks the digital future should be entirely less name-reliant to end the mix-ups and to better protect privacy. Until a change happens, the Mike Sager name is doing pretty well, at least for the writer, Mike Sager.
I'm just going to enter Mike Sager here. Mike Sager, journalist, author, comes up first of 32,700 results.
It's a little easier for him than others since he's a journalist. He signs all his work with his name. No one fixing a road gets to sign the road. But he hasn't forgotten about all the other Mike Sagers.
In life, that is the ultimate lesson, that all of us think we're the most important. You want life to go how you want it to for you and your name. You know, there's all these other people that feel the same way about themselves.
No one else is uniquely you, but you'll probably have to share your name. Elise Hugh, NPR News.
One of public radio's most popular personalities and a great guy, Tom Magliazzi, has died. Tom and his brother Ray became famous as Click and Clack the Tappet Brothers on the weekly NPR show Car Talk. They bantered, told jokes, laughed, and sometimes even gave pretty good advice to listeners who called in with their car troubles. Tom Magliazzi died this morning of complications from Alzheimer's. He was 77 years old. NPR's Lynn Neary has this remembrance.
If there was one thing that defined Tom Magliazzi more than anything, it was his laugh. It was loud. It was constant. It was infectious.
His laugh is the working definition of infectious laughter.
Doug Berman has been the producer of Car Talk since 1987. He remembers the first time he ever encountered Tom Magliazzi.
Before I ever met him, I heard him. And it wasn't on the air. It was, I'd be working in the station. I was the news director at the time. And I'd just hear this laughter. And then there'd be more of it. And people would sort of gather around him. He was just kind of a magnet.
The Magliazzi brothers grew up in a tough neighborhood of East Cambridge in a close-knit Italian family. Tom was 12 years older, the beloved older brother to Ray. They liked to act like they were just a couple of regular guys who happened to be mechanics. But both of them graduated from MIT. After getting out of college, Tom went to work as an engineer. One day he had a kind of epiphany, as he told graduates when he and Ray gave the 1999 commencement address at their alma mater. He was on his way to work when he had a near-fatal accident with a tractor trailer. He pulled off the road and decided to do something different with his life.
I quit my job. I became a bum. I spent 2 years sitting in Harvard Square drinking coffee. I invented the concept of the do-it-yourself auto repair shop, and I met my lovely wife.
Well, he wasn't exactly a bum. He worked as a consultant and college professor, eventually getting his PhD in marketing. And Tom and Ray did open that do-it-yourself repair shop in the early 70s. Later, they opened a more traditional car repair shop called the Good News Garage. They got into radio by accident when someone from the local public radio station, WBUR, was putting together a panel of car mechanics for a talk show.
You know, they called Ray, and Ray thought it was a dumb idea, so he said, I'll send my brother. And Tom thought, great, I'll get out of, you know, breaking my knuckles for a couple hours. And he went over, and he was the only one who showed up.
Doug Berman says the station liked what Tom did and asked him to come back the next week. This time, he brought Ray. The rest, as they say, is history. In 1987, Car Talk went national on NPR.
Hello and welcome to Car Talk on National Public Radio with us, Click and Clack, the Tappert Brothers, and we're broadcasting this week from the observation deck here at Car Talk Plaza.
The Magliazzi brothers were a huge success. Listeners loved their blend of humor, passion, expertise, and just plain silliness.
Well, this is the only theory of which I am sure in the entire world. You know, I don't know whether the Earth goes around the sun or vice versa. I don't know about electromagnetism, but I do know that it never pays to buy a new car.
Don't know much about biology.
Oh, God.
Hey, aren't you glad you called?
When it came to cars, Berman says the brothers really did know what they were talking about. But he says that's not why people listen to the show.
I think it has very little to do with cars. It's the guy's personalities. It's, you know, and Tom especially, you know, really a genius with a great facile mind, and he's mischievous. He likes to prod people into honesty.
Berman remembers the time a woman called in because she had failed to pay a toll on a bridge and was worried about getting caught. Tom had the idea of calling the person in charge of the bridge. The ensuing conversation is hilarious.
Why do you have to have a coins-only lane?
Well, we do have some to service patrons who have a commutation sticker on their window.
I don't think they're marked very well, Don, because I didn't see it until the last minute.
Well, kind of feisty for a lawbreaker, isn't she?
Yeah. I mean, hey, Gail.
Yes.
Cool it, we're going to give me a name.
And by the way, Gail, there is no statute of limitations on this. We can find you.
It is almost impossible to talk about Tom Magliazzi without talking about Ray. Berman says the affection you heard on the radio dated back to their childhood, and it was real.
For Ray, he idolized Tom. This was, you know, this is the guy who sort of introduced him to everything in life. And Tom liked having his little brother around. He liked the guy. And so when they grew up, they were really, really great friends.
Tom and Ray have not done the show live for 2 years. Car Talk has been airing archives of old shows. And Berman says Ray would like to continue doing that as a tribute to his brother. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Okay, let's talk now about major contributors to the tech sector of the economy, companies like Google or Microsoft or Domino's. Yeah, I said it, Domino's Pizza. Not an obvious choice, but still, as it turns out, a tech company. NPR's Elise Hugh explains.
All right, it's a quarter past 11, and I'm in a generous mood, so I'm going to buy some interns some pizza. This is Charles.
Hi.
And Nick.
Hi.
Both Charles Pulliam Moore and Nick De La Canal are ordering from Domino's Pizza because lately the company has gotten noticeably good at something that wasn't always its focus, developing technology products to get pizza to people more easily. It's Domino's VP Kelly Garcia's responsibility.
You know, innovation, coming up with the ideas is one side of the challenge, but then you actually have to be able to deliver it.
He's talking about delivering tech products. It's become the company's key ingredient for its recent success. Last quarter, its stock hit a record high, and its same-store sales have been climbing, while rivals Pizza Hut and Papa John's have stayed mostly flat.
This technology is difficult. It takes a lot of money, and it's complicated to put together. And so it just becomes a major differentiator for us when we look across the landscape of our competitors in quick service restaurants.
Domino's made its online ordering simple with pizza profiles in which you can save your, quote, easy order. So repeat customers get their usual order in just a few clicks. And there's the pizza tracker.
Oh, wait, there's a little tracker. Oh, I'm just noticing this.
As intern Nick is just discovering, the tracker is a progress bar that updates customers on their pizza order in real time. Step one shows an order was placed. In a Domino's store, this is what happens on the employee's end once that order comes in.
That's the internet alarm. Like I said, alerting us that we just got an internet order.
Luke Page fields orders like this all day.
And we'll just look up, see that it's a large hand toss, grab our large dough, and make the pizza.
Back at Nick's desk, he's watching his pizza's progress.
And now there's a blinking number two that says it's being prepped. Oh, there's like an animation with a pizza guy. He's like moving down the counter. Oh, this is so cool.
The tracker follows each pizza all the way to the point it leaves the store. To keep up with more trends, Domino's is now betting on voice control. It just rolled out Domino's version of Apple's Siri. His name is Dom.
He's like your personal pizza assistant.
Intern Charles gives it a try.
Welcome back to Domino's. Will it be delivery or carryout today?
I will have a large pizza with onions.
Pizza added.
Domino's says ideas like the pizza tracker and Dom came about because the company's biggest single department is IT. Its management is staffed with digital futurists, and it's looking outside for ideas.
There's a lot of creative people out there that are outside our four walls. You know, what sort of ideas and how can we enable potentially more of that behavior?
One partnership with Ford moves Domino's into the world of connected cars. You can now order a pizza from inside the control panel of a Ford Sync.
I'm just really glad that we weren't slow to react to what were the emerging trends, both socially as well as with the ordering clients.
If you ask them, reacting quickly is a cultural orientation. The company has adopted a Silicon Valley-style, fail-fast approach to rolling out new products ever since it famously fessed up in 2009 to its bland, bad pizzas. It has since embraced its failures, even in its advertising.
You're going to make mistakes.
Have you ever heard of the cookie pizza?
I don't want to talk about it.
Over at NPR, we have lunch on our minds.
But here's Nick now. Your pizza's here.
Thank you
Thank you, Nicole.
How'd this process go?
Okay, so I definitely ordered a pizza with onions because I wanted to keep it simple. And the pizza that I got came with onions and olives, which I'm not upset about, but it's definitely not what I asked for.
Whoops.
Whoops.
The voice ordering app Dom must have heard him wrong. Even much lauded new technology has its glitches. Elise Hugh, NPR News.
Google is in the midst of a long-running antitrust case with the European Union. So far, the tech giant has avoided steep fines, but the appointment of a new European competition commissioner has many wondering if Google has a rockier road ahead. From London, Christopher Worth reports.
Siobhan Raff has a problem with Google. She's the founder of a British-based website called Foundum that compares prices for things like televisions and other electronic equipment. And if you've never heard of Foundum, Raff says that's because of the way Google presents information when you search for something online.
Google is manipulating its search results to increase its profit.
She says Google does that by promoting its own price comparison services, like Google Shopping or Google's hotel and flight comparison services, while demoting competing companies like hers in its search results.
So, for example, if you're looking for, say, Canon digital camera,
Raff types the search terms into Google on her computer and up pop the results.
What you see right at the top is five big photos with big links to Google's price comparison service that actually prioritizes which links it shows first, by which advertisers pay Google the most.
And as Raff scrolls down, no other price comparison site, like, say, her price comparison site, appears in the first page of Google's results.
And as you can imagine, that's an extraordinarily powerful technique that siphons vast quantities of traffic to Google's own services. And that is crushing competition.
Raff's is just one of nearly 20 companies that have filed antitrust complaints against Google in Europe since 2009. And the biggest of those by far is Microsoft, which has its own competing search engine, Bing.
Microsoft has been driving these complaints from the very start.
Florian Wagner von Papp is an expert on EU competition law at University College London.
Over here in Europe, Google has an enormous market share. Over 90% of all searches on the web go via Google.
That's less than in the United States. Google was cleared of similar antitrust allegations in the U.S. last year. But in Europe, Google's practices are seen as a potential abuse of its dominance. It's been forced to submit three rounds of proposed changes to its search engine. And earlier this year, outgoing Commissioner Joaquin Almunia appeared to have reached a deal with the company.
I believe today that Google's new proposals are capable of addressing the competition concerns I set out to them.
In its proposal, Google agreed to display links to rival services alongside its own search services. But the commissioner has since rejected the deal. He blamed further complaints from Google's competitors. But Professor Wagner von Papp says his about turn may have more to do with wider European concerns about Google, like how much tax it pays in Europe and concerns about privacy and spying.
It was more these unrelated concerns that led to political pressure from mainly Germany and France on the commissioner, which is something that is very unusual in these antitrust investigations.
Under the new European Competition Commissioner, Margrethe Vestager, Google could possibly face more formal charges and potentially billions of dollars in fines. Some European lawmakers have even called for breaking Google up into separate companies. But Mario Marianello of the Brussels-based think tank Bruegel says Google may have a big market share for no other reason than Europeans really like it. And he says there's a risk in forcing the company to change.
The danger is you are essentially upsetting something that is actually working.
Google did not respond to a request for an interview. For NPR News, I'm Christopher Wirth in London.
Information wants to be free. That phrase has become a mantra in the internet age. For some, it's a way of explaining why so much writing and music and video is available online, free of cost to the consumer. The phrase actually predates the internet, and the original idea is a bit more complex. In 1984, futurist Stuart Brand was talking about the tension between the high value of information and the plummeting cost of distributing it. He said, on the one hand, information wants to be expensive, and on the other, information wants to be free. It's that first part, the expensive part, that's often forgotten. Well, now along comes writer Cory Doctorow with a new book called Information Doesn't Want to Be Free. Doctorow wants artists to get their fair share. And he argues the problem these days is that tech platforms, devices, and apps have more control over content than the people who make it.
I'm not really interested in whether the stuff that I get on the internet is free or isn't. I certainly pay for a lot of stuff. For me, the concern is whether or not the money that's spent when we buy things on the internet goes mostly to creators and then to their investors and then to the platforms, or whether, as it is today, the platforms have the whip hand and then the investors can extract monopoly rents from the creators, and then the creators sort of sit at the bottom of the barrel. You know, people have always found ways to get stuff for free, and certainly copying's not going to get any harder from here on in. You know, your grandkids will marvel mm-hmm. at how incredibly hard it was to copy in 2014. So the interesting thing for me as a creator is, how do I make sure that my share of the money that people spend is as large as possible?
And in the book, you do talk about the audience. You talk about the creators, meaning the artists, writers, singers, authors, the publishers and studios, and then also the platform, which I think most of us would recognize as the tech companies, whether it be an Amazon or an Apple or a Google. Mm-hmm. And you talk about this idea of copyright as protected by a digital lock. Can you give us a short summation of what you mean by a digital lock?
Sure. Well, if you've got an iPhone and you want to buy an app from someone other than Apple, you can't. Not because your phone can't run software, but because your phone has a lock on it that tries to stop you from loading software that Apple hasn't gotten a 30% cut of the sale price of. And, you know, under normal circumstances, you would expect that to just sort of be taken care of by markets, right? If you bought a dishwasher where you could only use the manufacturer's dishes, you would expect another manufacturer to make compatible dishes. Like if you have a K-cup machine, now the patents have expired. There's lots of people who are making pods for your K-cup coffee maker.
So the idea is, consumers would say, that's ridiculous. I'm going to go with another product.
Sure. Yeah, I'm a grown-up.
But you say here, when it comes to tech and these platforms, the platforms have real control. What's the difference? What's going on there?
Well, so what happened is, in 1998, we passed this law called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, the DMCA. And what it says is that it's against the law to remove a lock, even if you own the copyright to the work the lock is protecting. So, you know, one of the big publishers right now, Hachette, they've always insisted on digital locks on their ebooks. And they're in a pricing dispute with Amazon, who wants to take more of the money that they are generating through their books. And under normal circumstances, if Amazon decided not to sell Hachette's books, you would expect Hachette to say to all of the people who want to read J.K. Rowling or Amanda Palmer's new book, here's a tool that lets you convert your ebooks to run on iBooks or on Google Play or on Kobo or on Nook. Go ahead and just switch to someone else's store and buy your books there. But because only Amazon is allowed to unlock Hachette's books, even though Hachette controls the copyright, Amazon controls the lock, Amazon now runs that negotiation. They have all the negotiating leverage. And what happens is that the rightful share of the investor is expropriated by the platform.
So talk to us about what kind of digital copyright do you think would be fair in this kind of environment that would make more sense, at least to the creators, right?
So we can easily see how you could make a digital locks rule that didn't do this crazy thing. What you would say is that it's against the law to break a digital lock if you're violating copyright. And if you're not violating copyright, it's not against the law to break a digital lock. And that would solve the problem pretty handily, because then we can make tools that let people do things that are legal but that the manufacturer doesn't want them to do, which is a time-honored tradition. You know, whether that's plugging things into your cigarette lighter in your car that the manufacturer never intended for you to do, or using your blender to mix paint. You know, what we do with our stuff is our own business, and if we break the law, then maybe we get punished. But just using a product in an unintended way shouldn't be a felony. But I think the industry can and should sit down with its regulators and work out what the rules should be. The point is that if you have to care about copyright in order to just walk around in the world or use the internet, then something is deeply wrong.
Given all you've described, copyright is not dead. There's still some way to have kind of rules for the road. Can you talk about some ideas, what you think those will be or could be going forward?
Yeah, of course. I mean, once we give up on the idea of applying copyright to normal people and we limit it to the industry, we know how to regulate the industry because we know where they all live. And historically, the way that we have managed contexts in which it no longer became possible to control individual uses was to just let people pay once to use everything and then use statistical analysis to figure out who the money went to. So if you're at a radio station, you drop the needle, you don't call the record label to find out how much it's going to cost you to play a song. You just pay a single fee and then you figure out statistically at the end of the quarter whose music was played, and the money is dispersed that way. And the important thing is that, as imperfect as this solution is, it's way more perfect than adding censorship and surveillance to the internet in the name of making sure that people listen to music the right way.
What role did we play in this as the audience? I mean, every time we all sort of shrugged at the fact that Apple said you can only use this software, or, you know, we downloaded a music program and it was only in one format and couldn't be played elsewhere, it seems like we all sort of agreed collectively to that trade-off.
Well, I think we agreed in the sense that when you click that I agree button at the bottom of, you know, 7,000 words of abusive legalese every time you try to do something on the internet, you agreed. But I think that we shouldn't blame the public for having the intuition that if you buy something, it's yours and you will be allowed to use it in new ways. You know, when we bought CDs, we could only play them. And now we can rip them and we can use them as alarm tones and ringtones and we can stream them and back them up and do all kinds of other things with them. If you want to listen to a CD on your phone, you just rip it and load it onto your phone. You should be forgiven for not understanding that the DVD, which looks identical, is made in the same factory and is read in the same drive, doesn't have that feature because removing the digital lock is illegal. And I don't think we can really blame the public for not understanding that Congress had passed this completely ridiculous law and understand what its consequences would end up being.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Writer Cory Doctorow, the book is Information Doesn't Want to Be Free, Laws for the Internet Age.
This time last year, students in Los Angeles watched boxes of new iPads roll into their schools. Touted as the largest technology expansion in the country, the program ran into a host of problems, leading to the resignation of its biggest advocate, Superintendent John Dacey. KPCC's Annie Gilbertson reports on what's next.
Daisy told NPR he doesn't want Los Angeles Unified's iPad program to leave with him.
If it's dead, we're doomed.
But its future is out of his hands. Top administrators are now rethinking classroom needs. Should they look at laptops instead of tablets? School board member Steve Zimmer says the technology expansion isn't over, but it will be different.
I think that we'll get there by looking at the technology needs of each school and figuring out a personalized package, if you will, for each school site.
Zimmer says it's time for a fresh start. Daisy had canceled the iPad contract in August under mounting scrutiny over the fairness of the bidding process. Only 15% of students got iPads. Just as uncertain is the future of the educational software developed for the tablets by Pearson Publishing. Bernadette Lucas, head of LA Unified's initiative, says it's revolutionary.
Pearson is a doorway to a whole nother world for the kids around creativity, innovation, critical thinking, computational thinking, research.
Interactive lessons on tablets promise to engage students, and real-time feedback, if it works, should speed learning for those falling behind. But a recent survey of 15 LA schools with tablets found only one classroom used the Pearson app. Teacher Ben Way sees the software as more of a roadblock than a doorway. Way's students at Simon Tech Academy in South Los Angeles are mostly Latino, many from low-income homes, and are often behind in math.
So this is the grade 9 math, which is what I'm currently teaching.
Way fires up the Pearson app to show me how it works. The lesson begins with a short video showing cells dividing. Soon, the whole screen is filled with moving bacteria.
One cell divides into two, and then you have to count for two cells dividing into two, which is four.
Right.
Four cells dividing into two, which is eight.
How does it change each time?
Remember, this is a math class. Students have to represent this as a mathematical equation. But can they do it?
I get a lot of blank stares.
Way says the software should give students step-by-step examples and math problems to practice. But it doesn't.
You need to make up your own problems that are similar, and that sort of defeats the purpose of buying a curriculum.
Nevertheless, school leaders nationwide believe technology can transform classrooms. In fact, the bigger question is simply how to pay for it. Next week, voters in New York State will decide whether to buy $2 billion in bonds for school tech. School board member Monica Ratliff says L.A. was planning to use bond funds, too.
The reality is that we need a long-term plan in terms of how we're going to sustain this program. I haven't seen it yet.
The iPad for Every Student program would have cost more than $1.3 billion. Almost half of that, $500 million, would have gone for the tablets and the software. They've got the money now, but Ratliff wonders what happens with the next big bill that would come in a few years, when 650,000 devices would need to be replaced. For NPR News, I'm Annie Gilbertson in Los Angeles.